Fired up?
Sure.
Okay, the Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Wednesday, January 28th, 2015 will come to order. Good afternoon, everybody. I think we're really close to a quorum, but we just got a couple of reports today we're going to listen to and ask questions on, get any clarifications that members might want. So let's start out with the DNR Game and Fish Fund report. So I guess all three of you can come to the table if you want.
DNR, DNR.
And a quorum is present. Come to the table here, Carlin. Are you going to be doing a PowerPoint or no? No? Okay. Mr. Bogus, you want to go first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Ed Bogus, Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources. I have with me Linda Kelly, our Administrative Services Section Chief for the Division of Fish and Wildlife. And then we also have the Chair of the Game and Fish Budget Oversight Committee, Citizens Committee, Mr. John Hunt at the table. And Mr. Chair, I think in everyone's packet is a copy of the Fiscal Year 2014 Game and Fish Fund report to the legislature, and also a one-page handout. We thought we would, in the interest of time, work off of the handout, and you can see that there's a table of contents on the inside of the cover of the Game and Fish Fund report. If you want to see the detail that's in the report, we'd be happy to talk about any of that detail, but thought we'd just give you an overview of what's in the report and then stand for questions at that point. Just to talk a little bit about the Game and Fish Fund itself, it is an account in the state treasury that primarily gets revenue from hunting and fishing license fees and application fees, and then also the second major source of funding is reimbursements of expenditures of state dollars from federal excise taxes on hunting and fishing equipment that also gets deposited into that fund. The fund is currently in very good shape. That wasn't the case a few years ago before a fee increase for hunting and fishing licenses was passed in 2011. But it's now in very good shape, as you can see in the little chart on the front page. The current balance of the fund is around $20 million, and at current appropriation levels, that balance is expected to increase to about $25 million by fiscal year 2019. The primary reason for that increase, as I said, was the fee increase, and then also I think most members are probably aware over the last few years we've seen a major increase in the wildlife restoration dollars that have been coming into the fund or being apportioned to Minnesota from federal excise taxes on primarily firearms and ammunition. Those sales have skyrocketed in recent years, and we've seen a huge influx of dollars there. And in order to get those dollars get apportioned to the states based on the geographic area of the state and the number of certified hunters in the state, or on the fisheries restoration side, the number of licensed anglers. And so in order to get those dollars, though, that are apportioned to the state of Minnesota, we have to first spend 100% of non-federal dollars, and then we get reimbursed 75% of the excise taxes. Just a little bit on the authorities behind this report and behind the Budget Oversight Committee, the Citizens Committee. It's right under that chart that this annual report is required under 97A055. And we've been providing this report to the Legislative Appropriations Committee since, I think, 1993 or 4. The Game and Fish Oversight Committee was formed shortly after the requirement of the report to review the report and to make recommendations on what they found in the report. So that committee's been in effect, I think, since 1994. All of the reports, at least for a recent decade or so, are on our website, and the link is in the handout. Just an overview, this report is on the Game and Fish Fund, so it includes the operations account, what we call the dedicated accounts, which are stamp-type accounts or There's portions of the deer license that are directed to certain specific dedicated uses like deer management, deer and bear computerized licensing, deer feeding and servant health, and wolf management. So all of those types of accounts are in their own dedicated accounts that are now statutorily appropriated, but they're all covered in this report. And then there's also a fund that's in the Game and Fish Fund that comes from the in lieu of sales tax on state lottery. It's called the Heritage Enhancement Account, and that portion that relates to fish and wildlife is deposited in an account in the Game and Fish Fund, and that's also covered in this report. As I mentioned, the primary sources are the fees from hunting and fishing, and then the federal reimbursements. The hunting and fishing is about 60% of the revenue, and the federal reimbursements are about 25%. The remaining 14 is from those sources. Some of those sources I mentioned, as well as some miscellaneous sources. The spike in the wildlife restoration dollars can be seen on the three smaller charts that are on the backside of this handout. You can see the caption says 2000 to 2014, but actually these charts cover 2005 to 2014. So it's the last 10 years.
Excuse me, Mr. Bogustin or Osmek.
Sure.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you can see that on the left-hand side is what's known as the Pittman-Robertson Act. That was the act in 1937 that created the Wildlife Restoration Program, and you can see the spike in revenues over the last few years up to from about 11 or 12 million 3 years ago up to 16 and then 23 million, and it's being projected to be a little over 23 million in the current federal fiscal year, which hasn't yet been finalized. The sport fish is in the middle. You can see that's been kind of up and down, fairly stable, but actually down a little bit in the last few years, around the $12 million a year mark. And then the right-hand graph is just a total of both together. So the challenge that's creating, obviously, is that we have to spend the state dollars before we can get the reimbursement, the 75% reimbursement on the federal side. And so we'll probably be having discussions with this committee later on our budget initiatives that we're exploring to try to make sure that we're capturing all that federal revenue into Minnesota. Expenditures in the fund are detailed in this report by division, and then by some of the programs within divisions. In the case of the Fish and Wildlife Division, we've got a fisheries program, a wildlife program, an outreach program. We also have the license center in our division. About 68% of the total Game and Fish Fund expenditures in the last biennium were by the Division of Fish and Wildlife. And we detail in the report kind of the various categories of those expenditures and some of the major outcomes and results of those expenditures. About 22% of the expenditures out of the Game and Fish Fund are by the Division of Enforcement. So it's those two divisions in the DNR that primarily use Game and Fish dollars. Those funds are used for enforcing the hunting and fishing regulations, public safety, commercial use like fur dealers, commercial fishing, and hunter education, firearm safety. Then there's small amounts of the Game and Fish Fund that are in other divisions in the DNR, about 10% total. There's some in the Division of Ecological and Water Resources. Again, that section is detailed in the report for primarily habitat and population surveys, monitoring and management, mostly around streams, prairies, things like that. Parks and Trails gets 15% of the sport fish apportionment for public water accesses for fishing and boating purposes. Division of Forestry gets heritage enhancement money for ecological classification, native plant community work, and invasive species work. And the Division of Lands and Minerals gets an appropriation for the lands record system, the game and fish portion of that. There's also in the back of the report a section called dedicated accounts that details all those miscellaneous dedicated accounts that I talked about before, including the stamp accounts, trout and salmon, pheasant, duck, and the various dedicated deer accounts, wild turkey, walleye. Stamp is a voluntary stamp, but it does have a dedicated account for those that are sold, wild rice, and so forth. So, Mr. Chair, that's a very quick overview of the report. We'd be happy if people are paging through and have any specific questions on different sections of the report to go into those.
Okay, we'll start with Senator Osmond. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Bogness, page 92, the wolf management monitoring account. Is it safe to say that the receipts that we are going to anticipate for fiscal year 2015 are going to be decreased as a result of the placing of the wolf back onto the endangered species list?
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmond, the fiscal 15 receipts won't really be affected because we were through the season. The fiscal year started in July, but the fiscal 16 will likely be affected, assuming there's no quick action that changes the current status. The sources of revenue into the wolf account are the application fees and the wolf license fees. There's also 50 cents dedicated from each deer license that goes into that account. The latter would continue, but those first two would not.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bogness, so what do you generally think that receipt number is going to drop to? Right now it says it's $485,000. What do you think that, what would you project in fiscal 16 that's probably going to drop to?
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmond, it would drop in the neighborhood, it would drop to about $300,000.
Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One additional question. When you're talking about the expenditure section here, talks about wolf management. Because we are no longer going to be having a wolf sporting season, is it safe to say that we are probably going to have to invest more resources into the management of the wolf population, as in dealing with wolves that are getting into population areas? In other words, are we going to have to be hiring additional people to shoot or maintain the wolf population above what we're currently doing right now?
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmond, that's a very good question, and it's one that I don't have an answer to right now. Our position pre-delisting was that if wolves were federally protected, that the federal government should pay for the wolf damage control program, which they did up until the spring of 2011 when they cut the earmarks for a lot of things in the country, including the Western Great Lakes Wolf Control Program. So we're still of the position that it's not appropriate for the state to be funding that wolf control program, particularly with hunting and fishing license dollars, if the federal government is managing the species. So there's kind of an open question as to if that control is going to occur, who's going to pay for it?
Senator Sack, Senator Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Bogness, I was just wondering, is there a section on small game in the report? And more specifically, I'm just curious about the squirrel population, whether there's a breakdown on that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hur, there's not specifically this report is categorized by kind of functions within the department. So the expenditures for small game work would be in the wildlife section, but they're not. I don't believe there's anything specifically broken out for squirrels specifically in that section, but it's the section that starts on page 15. So you can see there's habitat management, population management, and so forth, and portions of those that relate to like managing forests and managing seasons would apply to squirrel management, but we don't have that itemized separately.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Sackler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bogus, given the fact that we had a ruling coming out of the court out of Washington, D.C., on our management of the wolf population, do we have any strategy to counteract that, or are we working at all to whether we have to go back to court or do it legislatively to so that we can manage the wolf, given what we've invested in already?
Mr. Chair and Senator Saxhog, we were a friend of the court party to the lawsuit, we did file a brief on the lawsuit. In that capacity, we can't file an appeal, but we are talking to the full parties of the lawsuit, encouraging them to appeal the D.C. District ruling. And then I know we've also been getting a lot of inquiries because this is happening in the federal court system, and under federal law, it's superseding what we can do under state law here. So I do know that there's interest from some of our congressional delegation, at least, in looking at if there's a congressional solution to this, as was done for some of the western states.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Boggess. With regards to the Citizen Oversight Committee for the Game and Fish, how are they appointed? How often are their terms? And who appoints them?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, thank you for that question. And they are, it is in statute what the various committee makeup needs to be in terms of a wildlife committee, a fisheries committee, and a budget oversight committee that combines members from both of those committees. There has to be a minimum of 10 of each. They're all appointed by the commissioner, and they're appointed for staggered terms that rotate, and we do. It's been done differently over the years, but in the last few years, we've started soliciting self-nomination. We'll put out a press release. We'll have a web form people can fill out if they're interested, and we ask a number of questions about their interest in the Game and Fish Fund, in hunting and fishing licenses they purchased, then we look for a balance of kind of geographic, gender, age, interest in fishing versus hunting, and the commissioner ultimately decides who to appoint. And we do have the current chair. He's been the chair for a couple years now of the overall budget oversight committee here, and Mr. Hunt might want to add something to this from his perspective.
I think what I would add to that, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, is...
Mr. Hunt, just say your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. John Hunt, Chair of the Citizen Budgetary Oversight Committee. While the creation of the Fisheries and Wildlife Committees is called out in statute, then those individual committees are able to select their own chair of their respective committee, and then they also select four additional members that will then comprise the umbrella committee, the budgetary oversight committee that I chair, and so those two individual committees sort of self-select to select members to participate in the higher level discussions.
And just to follow up, so in your meetings with the committee, in light of the increase in fees some 2-3 years ago that Mr. Boggess reported, are we in pretty good shape then? And what do you look for years out before we have to start looking at addressing this again?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, based on the information that has been presented to us in the current Game and Fish Fund report, we agree that the fund looks fairly healthy in the near term. I think, as Mr. Boggess had indicated, with the influx of the additional Pittman-Robertson funds, it's an opportunity to invest or perhaps front load in some priority projects that the agency maybe has had in mind that don't have a lot of tails to expenses or expenditures. But in the near term, I don't anticipate, at least certainly in this review cycle or even next fiscal year, that the Citizens Committee is anticipating that there'll be a need for additional fee increases.
And just one more, if I could, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up with regards to the Pittman Bowl chart, Mr. Boggess, so we generate roughly 25% of federal dollars, and in order to do that, you have to spend dollars. Is that correct? And has there ever been a time when they say we don't have enough money to fund that account, or is that just...
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, the excise taxes on the firearms and ammunition get deposited into a national trust fund, and then that gets apportioned out to all the states and territories based on the the population of hunters in the case of Pittman-Robertson and the area of the state. So however much money is in that account for apportionment is what we get an allocation of. Minnesota has never turned back any of those federal dollars. We have to, for every $100 that we spend on an eligible project under Pittman-Robertson, we get back $75 of that, but only up to our apportionment. So, you know, in our division, we're spending about $60 million a year total. Our apportionment is in that $20 million range. So you know, we have to kind of constantly be spending and getting reimbursed. But as long as we've been in this since 75 plus years ago, Minnesota's always been able to capture its full apportionment. Not every state has, because they don't have all the eligible projects that we've had to submit for that reimbursement. But I would say we are getting to where it's going to be difficult without some additional expenditure to capture that, leverage that full federal apportionment.
What does that mean exactly?
Mr. Chair, it means that so far we've been able to come up with enough eligible state expenditures, because we have to spend the state money first, then we get the 75% reimbursement. But if we ever reach a point where we can't spend enough to get the full amount that we're apportioned, then that will just cancel back into the trust account nationally and be reapportioned out in the next cycle.
Well, we should have projects before we spend money, I would think. So if we can't get it, are there restrictions on the federal money and how we can use it?
Mr. Chair, yes, there's in order to be eligible for this program, states in their statutes have to have two pieces of law, one that they will do everything required to comply with the federal aid program, and the other that they will not use game and fish license dollars for any purpose other than fish and wildlife purpose under the control of the state wildlife agency. So in that case, it's the commissioner of the DNR, which is why all the game and fish appropriations have to be made to DNR, even if we're going to do a transfer to another agency for something like venison donation in the Department of Agriculture. It first has to be appropriated to the commissioner to be in compliance with the federal rules.
So we don't really have any problem there, do we?
Mr. Chair, no, we don't.
So spending the federal money is pretty simple for us.
Mr. Chair, yes. The federal money becomes a reimbursement of a state expenditure, so it loses its federal identity. It just becomes part of the Game and Fish Fund itself.
Senator Ingersoll.
So to that, thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's a trust fund, a federal trust fund. Do you know if they're just reimbursing the states with the interest of that trust fund, or are they, what kind of a balance does the federal government run, just for an information? Do you know that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I don't know the detail of it, but they deposit those excise taxes into that fund, and there's one for wildlife, there's one for fisheries. There are some off-the-top things that come out of them. They're different for the two funds, for Fish and Wildlife Service Administration, for multi-state grants, for recreational boating and fishing in the case of fisheries, and then the remainder is divided up and distributed to the states and territories. So they don't really carry a balance. There's been some sequestering of some of that in recent years with the federal budget, but other than that, they don't accumulate a balance. It's not like a fund that's being managed and that we're working off the interest. It's more of a real-time. Funds come in, they're apportioned out.
And can the federal money be used for enforcement?
Mr. Chair, it can be used for hunter education, firearm safety type work in enforcement, but not for the regular enforcement of the laws.
Okay. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Baugus. I'd like to go back to the wolves issue just for a little bit. I got a couple of questions. First of all, you mentioned that the state couldn't appeal. What do you think the chances of the who can appeal actually doing the appeal, and what's the time frame for that? And is there any chance that we could get a stay of the judge's opinion or whatever you call that, where it isn't implemented, because you're basically going to be going from state enforcement to no enforcement or no regulation or no whatever? What's the outcome there?
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, we have been talking to all the other parties and to the Fish and Wildlife Service, encouraging the appeal, and right now, I'd say there's optimism that there will be an appeal, and that, and also on the second part of your question, that they would ask for a stay. My understanding, they first have to ask the district court, and given the district court's ruling, it would be very unlikely to be granted there, but then it would go to the Court of Appeals to decide whether a stay would be issued, which is a possibility that they could issue a stay pending the final outcome, in which case we'd go back to how we were, you know, prior to mid-December.
And, Mr. Chair, do you have a feel for what the time frame is for all that to occur?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scully, the parties have to decide on whether they're going to appeal by February 17th, and then beyond that, it's just kind of up to the courts on how quickly they respond. So it could be months after that, but it's hard. From what I'm told, it's hard to know how long that might take at that point. But we should know if there's going to be an appeal within the next 2 weeks.
And, Mr. Chair, thank you. And so now we're going to have a time period where there is no real activity in this area. And I gathered from what I heard you say about the state's position that this, because it's a federal regulation, they're responsible for paying for the trapping and the killing and the animal deprivation and all of that, that you don't think the state will be doing that. But I'm going to tell you, I don't think the producers are going to be understanding of that differential. And I think, Mr. Chair and Mr. Bogus and committee members, that we better take a look at what some of those expenses might actually be and what the potential is for that, because, you know, the animal producer out there is not going to understand perhaps all the intricacies of this fight, and he's going to expect us to step up and be helpful. And I'm wondering if, when you look at this account, there clearly will be some money left in it, that perhaps what money is there should be going into those initiatives of animal control or animal elimination, or perhaps payments to producers that have losses because of the wolves, because there's going to be a lot of pressure on us to do that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scully, there is a program for the payment of losses in the Department of Agriculture, so I'll defer on that part of it. But on the rest of it, I guess that's a policy question for the state if the hunters and anglers should pay for the livestock program.
Senator Scully.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Bogus, because Department of Agriculture isn't here, do you know, is there any money in that account?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scully, my understanding is right now that they have depleted that account, and they have a number of claims that have come in since that. But I do not know what their budget plans are in the current budget.
So, Mr. Chair, the issue is going to be there.
I think the governor asked for an increase in the money in that account in the ag. But I don't know if it's going to be enough, because if the claims are already so high that they don't have any money for it, maybe we need to do it. Does DNR interact with ag on this? Or?
Mr. Chair, yes. Our conservation officers are the primary people that verify that it was a wolf that killed the livestock. Then County Extension verifies the value, and then Department of Ag pays. So it's a kind of a three-part program that we cooperate closely with them on.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. And on that same vein, Mr. Chair, so the funding that talk to the committee about the 50 cent per whitetail license in Minnesota, where does that go, and how is that going to be managed with regards to the gray wolf management plan?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, at the time that the wolf was most recently delisted, and the wolf account was set up at that time, which was in fiscal year 13, I guess it would have been the legislative session of 2012, and that's when 50 cents from each deer license was designated to go into the wolf management account. It wasn't an additional 50 cents. It was an existing 50 cents. So right now we do have an active wolf management program that includes research and surveys and other activities that more than exceed the amount of money that's in that account. But that's why I say I think it's more of a policy question as to, should those hunting license dollars go to pay for a livestock protection program, or is there some, I mean, our position is the federal government should do it, but I don't know if they're going to step up and do it. And then, obviously, as Senator Scoie said, if they don't, I think something's going to need to be done, and that's the I think that's the big policy question.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, the 50-cent increase in the hunting license, I do recall that very clearly, and that should be noted that it has gone to the wolf management program, not depredation program. And maybe that is a good policy issue. Maybe we should be looking at, you know, if the deer hunters are still going to be stepping up 50 cents every license. The management program, I'm assuming, is up and running and doing fairly well. Does it need those dollars, or would it be better utilized? But over at the depredation program at the Department of Ag, but again, if it's going to be a federal issue, they should be ponying up for that, those dollars as well. So kind of not a really a question, more of a comment, I guess, Mr. Boggs.
Mr. Boggs, just out of curiosity, so if the federal money can't be used for enforcement out of the $82 million in the game and fish operations, is there any other places where we spend money that can't be matched by the federal money?
Mr. Chair, it's not everything that we spend can be matched by the federal money. It's got to be for approved projects and they're around things like population and season management, habitat management, research, recruitment, retention, hunter safety and education, but we can't use it for general operations type administration or general enforcement or things like that. So I'd have to, you know, I don't have the whole list of things that we can or can't spend it for, but we can't submit every expenditure that we have. It has to be for approved projects. That
Ms. Kelly, do you know
federal requirements for fish restoration or wildlife restoration?
Ms. Kelly, do you know?
Statement: we do write grants for eligible projects. So, but it is correct that work is not eligible for federal reimbursement.
Okay. And then,
just a point of clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Boggess, we have a waterfowl plan, I understand a pheasant plan, and other species plan. Do we have a deer management plan? Now, a lot of us are hearing about the whitetail population, and there's even talk of audits with regards to, you know, why do we have such a shortage of whitetail in Minnesota? Is there some talk of something like that coming forward? Anywhere we can help you at all with that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, we certainly could do a plan that kind of laid out the framework for how we manage deer in Minnesota. That, you know, the on-the-ground management of deer occurs in, as anyone who's a deer hunter probably realizes, in permit area-sized blocks, which is why we haven't gone to the kind of the statewide plan approach. But, you know, we can see some value in at least a document that lays out kind of how we manage deer overall in the state, what the goals are, and that sort of thing. But it still comes down to each permit area gets looked at individually, and we decide if it's going to be a lottery area or a hunter choice or a managed area, and set the quotas based on those individual permit areas. But we're hearing what you're hearing, and I
thank you.
You know, we're certainly open to you know, making that more clear to people as to what's guiding deer management. Where we're at right now, we agree right now deer populations are below where they should be in many areas of the state, as we brought them down intentionally and then had two harsher than normal winters the last 2 years. So certainly something we could continue to talk about, how we could make that more transparent to people.
Good. To that point, I just had an angry constituent in my office complaining about DNR not allowing deer feeding. So at what point do you allow people to help out with deer feeding, and what's your policy on that?
Mr. Chair, we don't have authority over feeding of deer except in disease emergency zones, which we have used a couple of times up in the TB zone and then down in the southeast in the CWD zone. Other than that, people can feed deer if they like. Last winter, we did have a state-sponsored feeding program with the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association using one of these dedicated accounts, the Deer Feeding and Servant Health account. Does provide for use of state dollars for deer feeding when there's a winter emergency situation declared. And there's, we worked back in the late 90s after the severe winters of 95, 96, and 96, 97 to develop a policy of what would constitute an emergency winter feeding situation. And that, those criteria were met last winter. We don't think feeding deer is a good idea because of the potential for disease and higher than normal, more concentrated deer in places they shouldn't be, but that was the policy. The money was there, and we did release that money, and the deer hunters did a good job feeding deer in those areas where it was declared. But this winter is far from a deer feeding emergency winter. It's one of the best winters we've seen for a while for deer.
Did I hear you correctly? Did you say you don't have authority over deer hunt over deer feeding?
No, we do not. We have a rule against baiting deer for hunting. So maybe that was what your constituent was concerned about.
What?
He wants to bait deer.
So who has the authority over deer feeding?
Mr. Chair, right now there's no one that has authority over deer feeding other than some local governments have passed ordinances prohibiting feeding in their communities because of the nuisance it creates. But there's no state agency that has authority over feeding except the commissioner of the DNR has authority over feeding of wildlife in a disease emergency situation. But other than that, we prohibit the use of bait for hunting.
We have a big hunt.
But not feeding of deer.
Well, you do have authority over deer feeding because you can decide that the deer should be fed because of an emergency. So am I talking about something different than what you're talking about? Or?
Mr. Chair, I might have misunderstood your question. What we don't have authority to do is tell people that they can't feed deer. If they decide they want to buy their own feed and put it out, they're perfectly legal to do so. We do have authority to decide whether the state will pay for the feed that they want to put out. And we did do that last year in certain areas where we declared a winter feeding emergency, but we haven't done that this year, and we don't anticipate doing that this year.
Centering a bit, sorry.
Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Bogus can clear this up too. The planting of deer feed, biological stuff. Everybody, I mean, that's the new thing now. The way time flies, I guess it's not new, but. So that's not considered. There isn't anything you can regulate there either, as well as far as private citizens on their own private property tilling up their land and planting this extra.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, that we consider that a food plot, and that's legal for hunting or just feeding the deer. It's not a regulated activity that we have a concern about.
Okay. Well, one last question. How much did we raise fees in order to get this fund balance up as far as it's gone?
Mr. Chair, it varied by license type, the fishing license. I'll preface it by saying the fees hadn't been increased for 11 years, and the Game and Fish Fund at that time was heading to insolvency. But the fishing license fee, I believe, went up from 17 to 22, small game. Had a similar increase. But I would also say that balance is not strictly due to the fee increase. It's also, you know, we've seen millions of dollars of federal apportionments increase in recent years. We don't think that's sustainable, so we're not going to propose spending new dollars that have long-term tails, you know, at any real high level because of the concern that federal revenue is going to go the other way one of these years.
And maybe it's an opportune time to lower the fees since we have $25 million in balances. But go ahead, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just an overview when you're looking at the financial part of the DNR game and fish budget, are fishing and hunting opportunities in Minnesota, I shouldn't say hunting opportunities, but are the licensing of hunting and fishing folks going up? Is it increasing or decreasing? Is it staying the same? Or?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, the fishing license sales are staying, actually both of them are staying quite constant. We saw a little bit of a drop in fishing license sales a year ago. Some of that was the cool spring, we believe, and maybe the fee increase had a little bit to do with it. Hunting license sales have been very stable at between 570 and 580,000 licensed hunters. We did see a little bit of a dip in deer licenses this last fall with the low predictions for harvest success with very tight regulations, but even then it was still just a small decline, and we expect that will bounce back with a recovery of deer populations. So it's been pretty stable for both, as opposed to many other states in the country that have been seeing declines in those numbers.
Mr. Vargas, I don't know if you're prepared to comment on the governor's budget or not, but it looks to me like he's asking for about $9 million more in the Game and Fish Fund expenditures. Can you tell us what we're planning to spend those on and what the reason for the increase is?
Mr. Chair, I wasn't prepared to go into detail on it, but it was released yesterday, and we do have we've kind of front-loaded some initiatives around more on the wildlife side because of this wildlife restoration issue that I just mentioned to increase our management of wildlife habitat populations, some research, shooting range expansion, some hunter-angler recruitment programs. On the fishing side, we've got a more modest increase proposed that deals with primarily we've lost pace with being able to do creel surveys on a lot of our lakes or population surveys. It really hurts our ability to manage those lakes. There's also an overall governor's proposal to help cover some of the increases in salaries and benefits that we've seen over the last couple of years. It's 1.8% of salaries over the first year and 1.8% the second year. That's across multiple agencies that affects the Game and Fish Fund. There's an enforcement component to help. We've just lost capacity with inflationary influences on our ability to do fish and wildlife management and enforcement management. So we've got change items we'd be happy to go, and I'm sure we will get a chance to go over with the committee that described those in more detail, but it's generally in that vein.
Is any of the $9 million increase eligible for federal reimbursement?
Mr. Chair, yes, and that's a large part of why we're asking for more of it front-loaded in the coming biennium and then not being asked for in the following biennium.
And have we reached our max at federal reimbursement, or will we be able to get more?
Mr. Chair, we're working on those recent reimbursements on getting the eligible expenditures submitted, and we don't have enough eligible expenditures identified at this time to get that federal maximum, which is part of why we're asking for this increase.
Is this amount that we received in 2014, is that our maximum, or can we get more than that?
Mr. Chair, the numbers that are on that handout are the maximum that we're eligible to receive in that year. What you'll see in the Game and Fish Fund statement, which is also in the back of this report, is what we actually get reimbursed in a year, so it doesn't match up. Those are the apportionments. What you'll see in here is what we actually bring in each year. So you'll see we're bringing in, on the wildlife side, $14-15 million a year. We're catching up on that backlog, but we're not sure we can get it all leveraged with our current expenditures.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Kelly, do you want to add anything? Did Mr. Vargas leave anything out that you want to throw in here?
Mr. Chair, no, Ed did a great summary.
Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, the $25 million excess in the fund, if we lowered fees temporarily for a year or two, what kind of a reduction could be sustained? Back to 17, $20, any comment or thought on that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum, the impact of that, I think, would be that right now we're seeing on our fisheries management, we didn't ask for as much of that increase because we're in kind of a deficit situation. There's an imbalance section of this report. And if we roll those fees back, it's going to increase the likelihood we're not going to be able to leverage all those federal dollars on the wildlife side, and it's going to really hurt our ability to effectively manage our fisheries on the fisheries side. I don't know what the amount would be to kind of bring it back to some sort of a balance. And if your interest was to reduce a fee to avoid building up a balance, we'd have to do some calculating to know what that would be.
Any other comments or questions? Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Okay. The next thing on the agenda, members, is the legislative auditor's report on the DNR forest management. And Mr. Nobles, do you want to kick it off?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Jim Nobles, legislative auditor. And Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for having us here to present this report, because I think we all understand how important this topic is. In fact, Minnesota's forests are some of the state's most important natural resources. They provide economic, recreational, and environmental benefits throughout the state. And a significant share of the forest lands are owned, as we know, by the state and managed by the Department of Natural Resources. And it's a very challenging task that they have, because in managing forest lands under their stewardship, officials in DNR's Forest Management Division must balance a wide range of public needs, interests, and expectations. They must do so not only because it's good management practice, but because it's a requirement of the law. Specifically, DNR forest officials must provide timber to help support Minnesota's important forest products industry. They must manage forests in ways that ensure recreational opportunities to hunters, trail walkers, bike riders, and many others. They must also manage forests in ways that protect the environment and preserve often very delicate ecosystems. Because it is such an important and challenging aspect of DNR's responsibilities, in 2013, several legislators asked us to do an evaluation of forest management at DNR, and it was approved by the Legislative Audit Commission. Carrie Meyerhoff was the manager of the evaluation, and Katie Reed assisted in that, and they're going to make a presentation to you on our report. I would just like to say, Mr. Chairman, thank you to the department. We do a lot of work over at the Department of Natural Resources. We do a lot of audit work and evaluation work, and it's a very professionally run organization. They're always extremely cooperative and helpful in the work that we do, so I express an appreciation to all of them. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Meyerhoff and Ms. Reed.
Who wants to go first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Carrie Meyerhoff with the Legislative Auditor's Office, here today to talk to you about DNR forest management. I'll just start by defining forest management as activities, or the absence of activities, that are undertaken to achieve particular objectives for forest land. The Forestry Division in the Department of Natural Resources is responsible for the management of state-owned forest land. And one of the key tools that they use to achieve objectives on that land is timber sales. So I'm going to give you a little bit of background information about the division and its responsibilities for forest management, and then I'll talk about what we call the forest management framework. I'll turn the presentation over to Catherine to talk to you about timber sales before concluding with some information about division funding. So DNR's Forestry Division administers approximately 4.2 million acres of land, and that's about 75% of the acres that the department is responsible for administering. State statutes define forest resources to include timber, but they also include other benefits of the forest, such as habitat, recreation, rare and distinctive flora and fauna, and a number of other resources. And state statutes direct the Department of Natural Resources to manage these forest resources according to the forest management principles of multiple use and sustained yield. And simply, multiple use means those forest resources are managed so that economic, environmental, and recreational benefits can be derived from those resources. And sustained yield means that they're managed in such a way that we all can enjoy those benefits now without preventing future generations from also being able to garner those same benefits. I wanted to say a little bit about our methods, because we did do a lot of reading of documents and statutes, and we analyzed data, but we relied heavily on the professionals at the Department of Natural Resources in doing our evaluation. The Forestry Division operates through the central office in St. Paul. There are also three regional offices. They're in Bemidji, Grand Rapids, and also in St. Paul. And then there are several area offices. We spoke to people from the Forestry Division, but also the Fish and Wildlife Division and the Ecological and Water Resources Division at the central office and at each regional office. And then we visited with area foresters in the seven areas indicated by the star. And when we were talking to these professionals, we were assessing the extent to which the department's processes and practices support its responsibility to manage forest resources for multiple use and sustained yield. And we concluded that the department, in fact, has established a framework for forest management that supports its statutory responsibility to manage according to these forest management principles. And we defined this framework to include forest management planning, the department's commitment to following best practice forest management guidelines, and the department's seeking, obtaining, and maintaining independent forest management certification. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about each of those three things. The Forestry Division's, well, actually the Department of Natural Resources' main forest management planning process is called subsection Forest Resource Management Planning. And subsections are areas of the state that share similar climate and distribution of tree species. In each of these subsections, there is a team that is focused on planning for the forests in that subsection. And that team includes representatives from the Forestry Division, but also Ecological and Water Resources Division and Fish and Wildlife Division. And through the process, there are opportunities for the public and stakeholders to contribute to that planning process. So through the process, the multiple perspectives are brought to the table about what is desired for the forests in that subsection. Part of the process is defining kind of the desired future forest composition for the subsection. So, for example, one subsection might want to increase the amount of jack pine in the area in order to increase biological diversity of tree species. Another might seek to maintain acreage of interior forest so that it's available for animals that prefer that habitat. So by having to plan for a future forest composition, it requires the department to be managing for sustained yield as well. This planning process results in a 10-year stand exam list, which is the list of forested stands that will be considered for harvest over the next decade in order to help achieve that desired future forest composition. And when we talked to staff, there were several positive things they said about this planning process. It has really integrated the planning of the three divisions when they're planning for the forest resources, and it has improved the interdisciplinary work. But they also had some suggestions for improvement, and that included continued improvement to interdisciplinary work, improvement in communication of policies and priorities from the top down, but also across all divisions, so they're all operating kind of from the same place.
Give me an example of interdisciplinary work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the question.
I'm glad you didn't have a ready answer, because I don't know what it is.
Well, broadly, it's a requirement that people who are trained in different disciplines, in ecological and water resources, in the Division of Fish and Wildlife, and in forest management, they all come from sort of different training and educational backgrounds. They have different disciplines that sometimes value things differently, but they have to be able to work across the disciplines and work together in order to try and achieve what's best for the state's forest resources.
Okay.
That's not a concrete example, but does that help?
It helps, but okay. If you got a concrete example, that'd be even better.
Do you have a concrete example? No. Okay. Then turning to the best practice forest management guidelines, we call them the best practice forest management guidelines, but these are actually the Minnesota Forest Resource Council guidelines that were most recently updated in 2012. The Minnesota Forest Resource Council coordinated the development of the original guidelines and the updating of the guidelines. And a group of stakeholders contribute to development of these site-level guidelines. And that group included, for example, state, county, federal, and tribal governments, private forest landowners, forest industries, conservation and environmental groups, hunters, a lot of different perspectives contributing to these site-level guidelines. And site-level guidelines are, for example, in a harvested area, you might leave some trees to make sure that there is habitat or food provided for animals or seeds that will help in the regeneration of the forest. So they're the guidelines that actually happen at the harvest site to try and prevent too much damage and try to make sure that the forested area can continue to provide forest resources sustainably. As I mentioned, DNR has committed to following these guidelines, and DNR staff were generally positive in their assessment of the guidelines and the impact on managing for multiple uses and sustained yield. And then finally, third-party forest management certification really validates the DNR's forest management approach. Since 2005, the department has had certified almost 5 million acres of forest land. That includes the 4.2 million acres administered by the Forestry Division, as well as acres administered as wildlife management areas by the Fish and Wildlife Division. Now, two different organizations, as I mentioned, have provided the certification. They're the Forest Stewardship Council and the Sustainable Forestry Initiative. Those two groups have developed standards against which DNR's practices are measured in order for the department to obtain certification and maintain certification. And the department has to go through annual audits where their actions are assessed against those standards. And when auditors have found things, and they have at times found things they think needed improvement, the department has always responded in a way that met the auditor's requirements and within the time required. The positive things that staff said about third-party forest management certification include the requirement that there be interdisciplinary work on forest management, a focus on unique natural resources that perhaps has required the department to attend to them sooner than they otherwise would have, and that this process also provides a platform for constructive discussions about continuous improvement and forest management. The downsides they cited were it adds complexity to the forest management tasks that they have, and it also takes time and money to meet those standards and also to participate in the audits. Now, as I mentioned, So we recommended that DNR should continue to improve its interdisciplinary efforts. Interdisciplinary work at the department is so important for it to be able to meet that requirement to manage for multiple use and sustained yield. And while staff did say that that has improved over time, they did note that there is still room for improvement. And I think this is something there will always be room for improvement because it is trying to merge these different perspectives. In addition, we think the Forestry Division should prioritize monitoring implementation of the subsection forest resource management plans.
Excuse me, Senator Scalzi has a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have, before we move on to that interdisciplinary effort, I'm wondering if they admit that there's room for improvement, have they detailed what they would do to improve the problems with the interdisciplinary efforts? It's hard to say.
Yes, Mayor Huff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi. Nothing is coming to mind right now. I know that the Department of Natural Resources did like an internal survey of their employees to try and find where there needed to be room for improvement. But at the time, I'm sorry, right now I'm not remembering what some of those steps were. Getting back to prioritizing the monitoring of the plan implementation. The department does devote substantial resources to this planning, and we think it's important for the department to be assessing the extent to which the plans are being implemented and that their implementation is moving the subsections towards their desired future forest composition. And now, as I noted, timber harvest is one of the primary forest management tools used by the Forestry Division, and I would like to turn the presentation over to Catherine Reed to talk to you about timber sales.
Ms. Reed.
So, as Ms. Meyerhoff just mentioned, the primary method that the department uses to achieve its forest management goals is timber harvest, and they have identified 800,000 cords per year as the amount that they can offer sustainably over time, and they make a commitment to offering that 800,000 cords of wood each year. Our exhibit here shows that in terms of new cords offered, the department has met the goal of offering 800,000 cords of wood for most of the last 10 years in terms of new cords offered. But when you add in pre-offered cords, they have offered at least 800,000 cords of wood each year. And re-offered cords are cords that didn't sell in previous years or cords that did sell but were ultimately forfeited by the timber permit holder. Exhibit. The yellow line shows that the Department of Natural Resources timber sales rates have declined over time. And the sell rate is the percentage of cords offered that did sell in a given year. From 2004 to 2008, timber sales rates ranged from 94 to 98%, and before dropping to 80% in 2009. And in 2013, timber sales rates were about 81%. And the red bars on this exhibit show that timber sales receipts have also declined in recent years. In 2006 and 2008, timber sales receipts topped $25 million. In 2012 and 2013, timber sales receipts were $17 and $16 million, respectively. Now, when we began our evaluation, people expressed interest in comparing the costs and receipts of the Department of Natural Resources with those of other forest land managers, and we determined that analysis would be very difficult to complete for a couple of primary reasons. First, it's very difficult to obtain comparable cost data between different forest land managers. And second, and perhaps more importantly, there are a lot of factors that vary between different forest land managers that can affect costs and receipts, but might not necessarily indicate better or worse performance in terms of overall forest management. So in lieu of comparing costs and receipts, we compare DNR areas that together cover St. Louis County and then some with St. Louis County's Land Management Department. And we looked at a productivity measure of new cords offered per full-time equivalent employee. And we calculated the full-time equivalent employees using activities only related to timber sales. And we worked with the St. Louis County Land Department and the Forestry Division to make sure that the data we use is as comparable as possible. And through this analysis, we determined that performance in terms of new cords offered per full-time equivalent was similar, with the three DNR areas, Tower, Hibbing, and Cloquet, offering about 14,000 cords per full-time equivalent, and St. Louis County offering about 12,000 per FTE, and that was in 2013. Through our...
What was the cost of the cords, of a cord?
But
did you have a cost factor on these also, on the cords?
If you, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. If you turn to page 80 in your report, it details the average price per cord of timber sold by the forest since 2013.
Okay, thank you.
So based on our interviews with DNR, foresters, and others, we identified several issues and made several recommendations related to timber sales, and I'll highlight two of those here. First of all, foresters were clear that the vast majority of loggers perform well and do good work on state timber sales. However, the small minority of underperforming loggers require significantly higher amounts of guidance and supervision, and those underperforming loggers can give DNR, forest industries, and logging in general indicated that there aren't currently sufficient options for preventing those underperforming loggers from continuing to operate on state sales.
What does underperforming mean exactly?
So typically when they design timber sale, there's a specific prescription where certain types of trees must be left behind. They also have regulations, the Forest Resource Council guidelines, which they must follow, that protect roads and soil from rutting or damage. So underperforming loggers would be loggers who possibly don't follow those guidelines as well as they could, or who aren't following a prescription the way that it was designed.
Is it an educational thing, or is it just a...
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure as to the cause of underperformance of loggers. Do you have a...
Senator Ingebretson, at this point.
Thank you, and to that point, Mr. Chair. So the state of Minnesota is contracting with these loggers, is that correct? And so what you're saying is we have no means to, well, I guess the word isn't punish, but to enforce the existing contract? I mean, I would think the private sector just simply wouldn't hire them ever again.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebretson, they do have the division can charge liquidated damages to loggers who don't comply with the prescription of the sale. So, for example, if a logger damages a tree that was supposed to be reserved for harvest, they can impose a fine. But there's currently no mechanism to bar that continuing to operate state sales in the future.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I would ask maybe Mr. Nobles, would that be the suggestion of the legislative audit, that the state of Minnesota get a little tougher, get a little more meat in the enforcement of bad habits or bad contracts?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebretson, I think that is certainly something that the committee needs to consider. I think the department has a position. Yes, I mean, as I think we said in our report, bad logging by some of these vendors does create significant problems. And so greater enforcement, I think, would be in order.
Okay. Go ahead.
So we also highlighted an issue related to permit extensions on state timber sales. Currently, the department issues one regular year-long extension for every extension for every permit. And they also occasionally offer blanket extensions for a larger number of permits for reasons such as poor timber markets or unseasonably warm or unseasonably cold winters. Foresters indicated that those permit extensions can create inefficiencies in terms of meeting forest management goals and in terms of administering timber permits. For example, if a permit is continually extended, then that can delay the forest management activities on that stand, and then in turn it would delay progress toward the disciplinary forest management plan, which Ms. Meyerhoff in terms of administering a timber sale. If a sale is continually extended, a logger might have to return to the site and remark timber sale boundaries if the paint has faded over time. So we made recommendations connected to each of those issues that I highlighted. First, we recommended that DNR establish criteria to identify those loggers who are continually underperforming to develop appropriate consequences for those loggers. So, for example, there could be graduated lengths of time that those underperforming loggers are prohibited from operating on state sales. In addition, related to permit extensions, we recommended that the Forest determine the costs and benefits of continuing to offer permit extensions, and also to consider developing incentives for timing. So, for example, if a logger receives a permit extension, he or she and then they would receive the deposit back if they complete harvest within the allotted time. So with that, I will turn it back to Ms. Meyerhoff to talk to you about forestry division appropriations.
And thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We just have a few more slides here about the forestry division's funding. So the Forestry Division relies on, you know, direct appropriations, open appropriations, and statutory appropriations. And the 2013 legislature appropriated $73.6 million to the Forestry Division for the 14-15 biennium. In addition to that direct appropriation, the division was expecting approximately $54 million in open and statutory appropriations. So, for example, a big open appropriation for the division is the appropriation for wildfire-related expenses. And an example of the statutory appropriation is that the revenue from the forest nurseries is appropriated to the division for the forest nurseries. So between the direct, open, and statutory appropriations, we estimated approximately $127.3 million for the 14-15 biennium. In addition, the legislature appropriated $2.96 million in bonding for reforestation and tree stand improvement. And activities that might be covered in that include, for example, site preparation after harvest, seed, the cost of buying and planting seeds and seedlings, and removing competing vegetation from the more desired species. This roughly $3 million was about half, less than half, of the amount that the department thought that it needed in order to meet the needs for these activities. Focusing just on the direct appropriations, you can see that there are several sources of funding contribute to the division's appropriations. The general fund is and has been the largest source of funding, and that's indicated by the red portion of the bars in this exhibit. That is followed by the forest management investment account, which is the yellow bars. And the forest management investment account is the account into which receipts from timber sales are deposited, as well as some additional revenue. And then you can see in 2010 and 2011, the big white bars eclipsed even the forest management investment account. Those were appropriations from the Outdoor Heritage Fund for acquisition of land and easements. So if we remove those, you can see a little more clearly that direct appropriations to the Forestry Division have declined since fiscal 2008. They picked up a little bit in 14 and 15, but they've remained below the 2008 and 2009 appropriation levels. And as you might also notice, the forest management investment account, that yellow portion, has been decreasing in the proportion of the funding that it's providing. So as Catherine explained, receipts to this account have been declining over time. And in fact, in 2013, the department had to cancel some of the appropriation from that account because of concerns about the fund balance. And at the time we were doing our evaluation, they were anticipating a negative fund balance this year, fiscal 2015. And so we recommend that the legislature reassess its approach to funding forest management activities on state-administered forest land. We did not provide a specific recommendation about what that new approach should be, but we wanted to raise awareness of the kind of status of the forest management investment account and possibly its unreliability as a source, a significant source of funding for the division moving forward. And with that, I'll conclude my comments.
Senator Rood.
Mr. Chair, and I don't know who's the best to answer this question. Maybe it's Mr. Nobles. But this is a huge report to kind of digest in this short period of time. But on page 8, it talks about the school trust land. And it says that nearly 2.5 million acres of the school trust land makes up the majority of the Forest Division administered land. That's a huge piece. And in 2012, the legislature had a big piece big bill that passed that was really pretty exciting for the school trust lands. And we did new management of the school trust lands. And in that, we put together a commission, and we've been working very hard on that. But I see nowhere in this report where it talks about a school trust lands director was supposed to be appointed to help manage the DNR, help with the DNR forest management. And it's been, this is going on the third year that hasn't been done. And so I'm really wondering, would that not play into the good management that director of this huge piece of land be appointed by the governor?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rood, the department's here, and you obviously I will probably want to hear from them on that point. But actually, I think that question brings us back to what was talked about earlier on the interdisciplinary approach. And frankly, when I saw that in the draft, I thought, that's kind of a fancy word for what I think is just people who have different goals and interests within the Department of Natural Resources. And now you have someone who's supposed to give greater emphasis to using the land, the school trust land, to raise money for the trust fund. But obviously, doing that, taking into consideration all the other interests, constituencies that care about how the land is used. And so you may be able to maximize money for the trust fund by cutting down more trees, but there are people in the department who have a different goal, a different interest, and they should. They have an interest in wildlife, or they have an interest in maintaining the aesthetics of a forest land because there are trails there. That's all that means. It frankly is the same thing within the department that would exist on this committee. If we put this committee in charge directly of running the forests, you would probably bring different interests and goals. You'd emphasize them a little differently. Some of you may emphasize using the forest land, particularly the school trust land, for a more accelerated generation of income. Somebody else might be more interested in the impact of that on the environment or on wildlife or on the deer population. We heard from just a few minutes ago about concern about the deer population. But you have people in the department who say a very large deer population is going to be problematic for all the seedlings that we are planting out there and doing damage to the other forest products that we're trying to raise. And so all this means is that, you know, you need all of these people around the table. It's probably why this committee is composed of people with different interests and different perspectives, different goals that need to be meshed together. But back to your point, Senator Rood, yes, the legislature has put greater and greater emphasis on the department's need to recognize that the school trust land is there to generate money for the trust fund. And we talked a good deal to the commissioner about whether or not that has added pressure on forest management in a way that they have had to abandon some of their other objectives that are statutory. Sustained use, multiple use sustained over time. And I can't answer the question of the governor appointing that person and how that's working out. I think you're going to have to ask the department that. But clearly, it's an important aspect, an added complexity to managing all of these forests. Sorry for the rather long answer, but I think it really did bring into focus what we're talking about when we talk about this interdisciplinary approach.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Nobles, I really appreciate that. It's a complex issue. And that's why I think it's so very important that that person be appointed to bring that point of view to the table so that, the school trust land is part of the conversation for good management. Of all the concerns that we bring to the table.
Senator Sackler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my comment, first of all, the recommendation, which is correct, I think the legislature should reassess its approach to funding management activities on state-administered forest land, is particularly valid when we talk about the school trust lands, which at one time were managed they were managed actually like the rest of the DNR lands, a portion of it went into, if there was any profit off those trust lands, it went into the general fund. and that wasn't the DNR's fault. But so at the point where we are now with the trust lands, we're basically saying that the trust lands, all proceeds of the trust lands, should go into the school trust account, and the DNR needs to foot the bill for the management, meaning we need to take care of that in the general fund. So if you see an increase in forest management in the general fund, you know, a lot of that is the result of the fact that much of the management of the forest that we do that they have responsibility for, you know, there's no margin, so to speak, for them to be paid out of that proceeds. So we need to foot the bill in the general fund. And that's the same with Mr. Vanderlind, you know, that's taken care of in the general fund rather than paid for by the school trust lands, which if we think that that's important, and I happen to think it is, for our schools, then that's the way we should be doing it.
Senator Rue, did you want the DNR to comment on your question?
Mr. Chair, it's really not necessary. I just wanted to bring to light that that's a very important piece, and when we don't have that administrator, then we end up with problems and questions about how it's being done. And so I just think that that's a really important piece to good forest management.
I love this interdisciplinary coordination thing, so I just got to ask you one more question on it. So, So in your report, it says, for example, DNR staff indicated that sometimes differences of opinion between divisions about a particular strategy may delay management activities for many years. In contrast, while private land managers may employ wildlife biologists or ecologists, they are not required to follow the same interdisciplinary process. How does that play into the whole bit of private people selling their property as opposed to the DNR, and does it result in DNR not selling things they should be selling? It sounds like it does, but anyway, I'm not sure if you got that far in your investigation or not.
Mr. Chairman, I think the basic difference there is that it's the difference between private land and public land, and the fact that, as we said at the beginning, since these are public lands, there are many different constituencies who want to use them for different purposes. And a private landowner may not have to, well, doesn't have to accommodate all those competing interests. I mean, with our lands, we have to accommodate people who want to go out and hunt, snowmobilers, trail walkers. We do have to provide forest products for the forest industry. So we have multiple constituencies and interests that have to be accommodated because they're all part of the public. The private landowner doesn't necessarily have that kind of a situation at all.
Okay.
So, yes, Mr. Chairman, it may mean that there is some land or with some forest, some trees there, that a private landowner would sell, cut, but that because there are other interests that have to be considered, that DNR would not do that.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a budget year, and I know that it's a very good thing for this committee to have the legislative audit department here, because this is how we assess our departments, but it's also how we assess how we're funding our departments, which gets back to this whole general fund issue. And there's a couple of things that I think that, well, first of all, I think we should have more time to speak with the legislative auditor and the department in relationship to what they've recommended. But in addition, there's been a couple of things that I think we could do a little bit more efficiently, and I don't know if the legislative auditor would care to comment, but one is the consolidation conservation land, which is close to a third of what we manage. And we still have to pay 50% of those timber sales on those lands to counties because of our sort of sordid past with trying to make land farmable, and it really wasn't. But that's one issue I think that we're losing a little bit of money on. And then the other issue, and I know this is a different report, but the Sustainable Forestry Incentive Act, we spent $44 million in a 10-year time period on that. And I'm not sure if we have corrected some of the problems. That was quite an involved report relative to how much we're collecting and if we're doing it right with proper landowners. I think those are two possibilities of maybe increased funding for forest management, and it may take another meeting, and maybe the legislative auditor would care to comment on that.
Mr. Knowles.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we would appreciate an opportunity to come back and talk about that other report, because I do think there is a need for that program to be integrated more fully into the department's forest management. And so it has its own issues, as you well know, and they're very controversial. There has not been a lot done in response to that. There would potentially be a good deal of concern, particularly by some landowners who potentially could lose some of the tax advantages that they have now under that program if you were to change it significantly. But again, I really appreciate your mentioning of that, and we would welcome an opportunity to come back and talk about that report and this one in more detail. And I definitely, Mr. Chairman, believe that you should hear from the department on many of these issues as well.
I was going to ask the department if they wanted to comment now, but is there too much to comment right now, or can you do it real quickly? And
I'll go as quickly.
Good afternoon, members. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Forrest Bowe. I'm the Director of Forestry with the Department of Natural Resources. And I just want to make a couple of comments with regard to the report. As you can see, the auditors spent a considerable amount of time on the report, and they interviewed our staff both in the field and in our St. Paul office, and we really do appreciate their thorough review of our forest management program. I think the report accurately depicts our programs and identifies the issues that we're facing, and overall it's a really good reflection of the work we do and how we go about doing all of that work. So if you haven't had the opportunity to look at the report, I made it mandatory reading for all of our staff in our division. It's very clear, concise, really have appreciated the findings in the report. As a matter of fact, we agree with all of the findings, and you can see those on the blue page in the front of the report.
What do you think of these interdisciplinary things?
Mr. Chair, the interdisciplinary work really is critical. We bring in our interdisciplinary teams when foresters don't have all the answers. If there's special concerns around a species or some water quality issues that we're unsure of, we take advantage of our interdisciplinary teams to do that work. The report also says that we need to continue to improve that, and I think the areas there to improve are certainly in our communications, improve on the types of things that we're going to coordinate with others on, and also when we don't agree, what's that dispute resolution process look like so that these things don't linger? So those are some comments.
That may go on for many years thing was kind of concerning.
And Mr. Chair, yes, we are concerned about that as well, and okay. We certainly don't want that to happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else?
I'd love to take time with the committee to talk more, and I know that we will in the future. But overall, I think we certainly support the recommendations and appreciate the auditor's work on the report.
Senator
Scalzi. Stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bowe, related to the Sustainability Forest Incentive Act, and from what I'm hearing from the auditor is that some people with forested lands who are having a current tax credit would stand to lose some money. And I guess as we're talking about supplementing a forestry budget to manage the forests in a better way that all the disciplines can agree, it's not the responsibility of the taxpayer of Minnesota to make sure that someone gets a tax credit if they don't deserve it. And where that 2013 report, I have not seen any legislation that's passed or been presented since, and I could be wrong on that. But these reports are so important to the taxpayer of Minnesota. And if we get these very valuable reports and then don't do any legislation if that's required to correct those reports, or if we don't do something within the department to make sure that the taxpayer is protected, then we're not doing our jobs here. I guess that's my comment. So I don't know if you want to comment on the SFIA and what has happened since that scathing 2013 report.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi, I would look forward to hearing the auditor's review of that report as well. And as you know, the report we're talking about today is about state-managed lands and how the state does their work in the forest. And really, the SFIA is about that private incentive to do forestry-related work and to limit parcelization of our forests. And so I think they are two very distinct things that are very important to the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, it is my understanding, and I don't want to speak on behalf of others, but that there are people working, trying to put all the various interests that are affected by the Sustainable Forest Program. There's a task force that's working on trying to find where they could come forth in a united way with some recommendations for the legislature to consider.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Senator Scalzi, why don't you have Mr. Bowe come to your office and explain it to you, and then if you think we need to do another committee hearing on it, I'll be willing to do that, okay?
Thank you. Okay. I think that might be helpful. Thank you.
In fact, Mr. Chairman, just presented to me, I guess there is now a report, I don't quite know the status of it, but recommendations that are being made by the stakeholder group that was put together for revisions in the Sustainable Forest Incentive Program. But again, I don't want to speak on their behalf or put this forth on their behalf. It's the working group, the task force that has done this, and I think, again, they're another group that you'll want to hear from.
Okay.
And I think, Mr. Chair, we should get a copy of that report from that task force. That would be helpful to me.
All right.
As we're looking for how much money we're going to put in this budget, because this is a huge issue
for the
future.
Yeah, we may need more money in this budget. So.
Right.
Anyway. Okay. This is going to be a common problem this year, and that is that there's another committee coming in about 10 minutes. And so if anybody's got some final comments they want to throw in here or add, now is the time because we got to get out of the room. So if I don't see anybody else jumping up here. So, all right. Thank you all very much. I appreciate the work of all of you, and meeting adjourned.